Welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. It's been a difficult week for all of us here in Georgia. Before we do anything else, I want to extend to all of you the best hopes and wishes from me and our production team that you recover safely and as quickly as possible from the damages of Irma. Hurricane Irma blew a hole in our production schedule this week, and so we've reached into our archives to bring you one of my favorite shows from the past year. It's a conversation with writer George Saunders. Saunders has won acclaim for the short stories and essays he's written for The New Yorker, Harper's, and other publications over the past couple of decades. 4 years ago, when his short story collection, The 10th of December, was released, a New York Times Magazine cover story carried the headline, "George Saunders has written the best book you'll read this year." Many critics agreed it was an exceptional work. So when Saunders let it be known following the success of 10th of December that he was working on his first novel, expectations for what he'd produce began to build in literary circles. We talked with Saunders in March, shortly after the publication of that long-awaited novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. The book has won extravagant praise from critics, many of whom have called it a masterpiece. Here's our conversation. George Saunders, thank you so much for joining me for Two-Way Street. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Well, Bill, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I finished Lincoln in the Bardo last night, and maybe because I came to the end of your book last night, as I thought of the words that I would want to use to describe it, the first two that came to my mind were moving, because it is incredibly moving. It's hopeful. But I also thought about the fact that it is thought-provoking. It's at times terribly sad. It's funny. It's poetic. It's also, George, really weird. And
yes.
Knowing the body of your work, it occurred to me that I've either just really insulted you at the very start of our conversation, or in fact, you kind of like that idea.
I do like that idea. You know, because to me, weird just means, you know, it's sort of challenging our habitual way of seeing things, you know. So, you know, we go through a day being non-weird because that's how you get taxis and stuff and pay your bills. But every so often there's a moment in the day when you think, wow, you know, I'm on this earth for a short time. I only understand a tiny fraction of experience. And to me, when someone says weird, that's kind of what I hear anyway, is that, you know, the book has allowed some access to that little moment of actually what I would say truth that comes in a long day. You know, I think part of the purpose of art is to sort of at least once a day remind myself that even though everything seems normal, the world is actually quite strange, you know. And when a work of art or a moment presents as weird, that's kind of like this bigger truth intruding on our normal kind of slothful habits. So I'm okay with that.
Tell us, where did the idea for this book came from?
Well, it was just 20 years ago. We were in D.C. with my wife's cousin driving past Oak Hill Cemetery, and she pointed out the crypt where Willie Lincoln was temporarily interred back in the 1800s. And then she just threw off this little detail that the newspapers at the time had reported that Lincoln had actually gone into the crypt. He was so grief-stricken that he went in there to view and possibly even hold the body at some point. So that kind of exploded in my mind at that time, and I made a real impression.
You have said at one point that this was such a scary idea because it seemed so profound to you that you were afraid to go near it. And I think you've said that you finally decided to tackle it because there was an epigram you did not want to have on your own gravestone. Do you remember what you said that would be?
He declined to do that which he most longed to do. Yeah, it was... You know, scary in the sense that I felt like I'd got barely onto the, you know, into the literary world by being funny and dark and kind of futuristic. And, you know, when you fight a long fight like that to find your own voice, you're kind of loath to give it up. And I knew that this book would require a little bit of stretching. And so finally, I just had that kind of, it felt to me like a kind of a moment of artistic reckoning where you say, look, I'm whatever I was, 53 years old. I'm either going to take this chance and maybe screw it up, or I'm going to be frozen the rest of my life trying to sort of self-imitate. So it seemed like a pretty clear choice. And, you know, the danger is in art is that you'll just be so satisfied with yourself or so afraid that you'll go into a kind of a death spiral of repetition. And that seemed not a lot of fun.
Yeah. So you went ahead, you plunged in, and the book has gotten remarkable reviews. We know it's important not to give much away here, because I think one of the joys of this book is it is our getting to figure out some of the things you're talking about that you tell us about as we move forward. We kind of have to figure out the landscape in which we're living, what the characters are doing. So I promise you, no spoilers here, okay?
Okay, that sounds good.
But I do think it's fair to say that this entire book, for the most part, plays out in a period of about 24 hours after Willie Lincoln, 11 years old when he died, is that right?
Mm-hmm, yep.
Dies completely unexpectedly. And it plays out in the 24 hours after that in the cemetery where he's temporarily interred. And we are going to meet a collection of characters who surround him in that cemetery. Fair enough?
That's fair enough, yep.
You have two guides, primarily. One of them is Hans Vollmann. What can you tell us about Hans Vollmann?
Well, he's a guy who was in his 50s, and he had an arranged marriage with a much younger and very beautiful woman. And on their wedding night, it was clear to him that she wasn't all that into him. And so, being a gentleman, he declined to consummate the marriage, and they just lived together as friends for maybe half a year. And then on, say, Wednesday night, she wrote him a note saying, you know, you've been so kind to me. I think it's time for us to take this next intimate step together. And so he was happy to hear that. And then Thursday morning, full of anticipation, he went to work and he died. So wah, wah, wah for him. And so his ghostly presence is full of longing for this woman. So all of these ghosts that are in this graveyard are there because they just couldn't somehow accept that they were dead. They had something in their life that filled them with regret or anger or longing. And so, you know, like a lot of us, they're kind of have a little obsession that they're trying to work through. So he's kind of the, I kind of thought of him as the scarecrow of the book, you know, in Wizard of Oz terms, kind of the more friendly of the guides, I guess.
He talks about being confined when we first meet him, and he tells this story about going home to consummate this marriage. Finally, he talks about being hit on the head with a beam, and he talks about, unfortunately, he's at least temporarily confined to his sick box. It takes us a while to understand what he means by that. But the fact of the matter is, these characters, Hans Vollmann, Roger Bevans III, who is his companion who narrates, who's kind of our co-guide in this, none of these people really understand at this point they're dead, and they don't want to let go of life, right?
Right, right. And, you know, I did a little bit of research in the kind of parapsychological literature, and that's one of the almost comic things that these mediums will say is that one of the first sort of, you know, simple level ways of getting rid of a ghost is to get it to understand that it's dead. So one of the techniques is to say, ask the ghost, what year is it? And when they say 1724, whatever, you say, no, actually it's 2017. And even sometimes they'll show a newspaper. So I thought that was kind of sad and kind of sweet, you know, that's all it takes in some cases. So these ghosts are they're kind of like in denial. They, to some extent, they know that something's not right, but they're so full of longing to be back in the big leagues with us in actual physical bodies that they kind of talk around it. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe the way that addicts do, you know, or people with real issues that don't want to confront it directly. They're always kind of, you know, talking around it in some way.
So on the evening after Willie is interred, all of the ghosts are somewhat startled because who comes into the cemetery to visit?
Well, Lincoln comes, yeah. And they don't know who he is. Yeah. They don't know that he's president, but they know he's alive. And for them to have a living visitor after hours is kind of unprecedented. And so they kind of come to see Willie as a celebrity, you know, this guy who's in the same category they are and is actually getting a visitor. Because some of these people have been there for maybe 15, 20 years, and no one ever comes to see them. And so part of the, you know, a book kind of, it teaches the writer about itself. And one of the things I learned writing this book was that these dead people were really kind of touchingly feeling themselves as second-class citizens, and they can vaguely remember a time when they were alive and they were more vital, and it really kind of hurts their feelings that no one comes to see them, and it really bothers them that they seem to have no ability to influence the living anymore. So when Lincoln comes in the flesh and is so clearly in love with his son, it's very moving to them, and it kind of awakens them to some new possibilities in themselves, maybe.
Yeah, you suggest that I think you basically tell us, or that we learn this from the various voices that we get to meet in your book. They're frustrated because you call them second-class citizens. They have no ability anymore to influence anything. They can't act upon any. I mean, one of your characters is Professor Edward Bloomer. He's frustrated because he had all these scientific discoveries that he thought nobody ever appreciated. And his pal is, what, Lawrence Ducroix, who wants nothing more than to go back to his beloved pickle factory, but it's gone, right?
Right. I had to laugh because... I mean, I always have that fear that, I think we all do, that we're living so vitally and, you know, to us, our stuff is so important, whether it's a book or a store or even our families, you know, we spend all this effort. But then you look back at people who lived 150 years ago, and of course, most of them are forgotten. Most of their efforts have gone to dust. And, you know, in Buddhism, they call that impermanence. And one of the ideas that you're a functioning person is that you accept that idea. But personally, I have a hard time accepting it about me, you know, that my efforts are going to be, they're fun for me, but in another 100 or 200 years, they'll all be gone, you know. So these ghosts in particular are a little crestfallen to find out that whatever it was they believed in their lives has passed. And, you know.
So we should explain the title. And you've just really mentioned Buddhism. Are you a practicing Buddhist?
I'm an aspiring practicing Buddhist. I come and go, and unfortunately, but yeah, I found it a really beautiful tradition, and it's been very important to me.
So, what is a bardo in Tibetan Buddhism?
Well, bardo just means transitional state. So, technically, we're in one now. We're in the bardo between birth and death. The book is referring to the bardo that starts at the moment of your death and goes to whatever comes next. So, in Buddhism, it would be when you're reincarnated, or in Christianity, it would be, I guess, the judgment day. So I took that. There's the Tibetan Book of the Dead is a wonderful text that explains what the bardo is. And I kind of took that as a jumping off point. But my bardo is kind of mine. It's not, you know, I wouldn't look to my book for any kind of actual lessons on what's going to happen after death.
We're going to take a short break right now. More with author George Saunders when we come back. If you're just joining us, we're revisiting one of my favorite shows of the past year. It's a conversation with writer George Saunders. Over the past few decades, Saunders has won acclaim for his short stories and essays, which, among other honors, led to his being named a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant. We talked with him in March, shortly after publication of his first novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. The book is set among the ghosts who inhabit the cemetery where Abraham Lincoln temporarily interred his son Willie, who died at 11 years old, even as Lincoln was prosecuting the Civil War. This is 1862. Lincoln is in the throes of the Civil War. It's not going particularly well for him at this point. Willie's death has profoundly, profoundly impacted him in a way that he's in the depths of despair. So that's going on during all of this. And your book moves us toward a place where Lincoln learns something from the experience that he gets with all of these ghosts around him. He comes away from this experience stronger in his commitment to fighting the war, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the kind of enjoyable things about this was to say, okay, this happened on a particular night in February 1862. And you can kind of, after that, trace what happens both in the war and in Lincoln's family life. And then, especially, I think, in relation to his understanding of what the war was about. So to me, I thought, well, you know, who knows? We can't know. And Lincoln was actually very, very private about these things. You know, everyone knew he was suffering, but it's not like he wrote an essay about it. But it seemed to me that certainly what would happen under all this pressure is that somebody like Lincoln might be sort of tenderized by the experience. Mm-hmm. In other words, having suffered himself, he looks up, he sees the immense suffering, soldiers dying, slaves suffering, and all this. And I think if you kind of track him historically, that his views got broader. You know, as the war went on, his ideas about race changed. He also seemed to be sort of interrogating God. He was not, as I understand it, a particularly overtly religious guy. But as the war progressed, you can hear him or see him saying, "Okay, if God is real, what does God want from this? Why is God not ending this war? Why is God not ending slavery more quickly?" So my sense is his sorrow, you know, beat him down so hard and kind of reduced so many of his illusions and his ambitions that he was able to really see things in a very stark and yet kind of transcendent way.
Yeah, and one of the things that is so, I think, somewhat chilling and very moving about this place, this cemetery with all of these ghosts and Lincoln surrounded by death, is that he recognizes that there are going to be many mothers and fathers who are going to lose children as he's lost his. And at least one of your ghosts has an experience where reliving a battle in which bodies pile up and up, it certainly evokes for us the image of what's happening in battlefields all over.
Yeah, and this happens kind of at the moment when the whole country is sort of realizing that this is not going to be a symbolic war or a short one. I mean, there's a lot of writing about the idea that this will be a couple skirmishes and the South will come to its senses. And this night is about a couple weeks maybe after Fort Donelson, where there was 3,000 deaths, which was the highest to that point. So I think everyone, including Lincoln, sort of realized what the scale of this thing was going to be. And then there's a moment in the book where he's just come from seeing his son's body and he kind of flashes on the notion that this is the first of many young deaths that are going to be enacted, and that all of them are going to have an attendant grief of the same magnitude that he's feeling.
The book is told by the audio edition of the book promotes the fact that there are 166 voices in the book. How many are there, in fact, that many characters that you've created to tell this story?
Well, the voices, some of them are, I use a technique of sampling actual historical texts. So some of the 166 is correct, and we know that because we did an Excel spreadsheet. But those some of those voices are historical
characters.
So, for example, Doris Kearns Goodwin is a voice. Elizabeth Keckley is a voice. But in all,
we should
had
point
to
out
use...
Doris Kearns Goodwin, of course, is still alive and with us.
Yes, yes. Thank God. She's so wonderful.
I wonder what your dreams must be like. Because the imagination, I mean, in all of your writing, the imagination that you show is always remarkable. But I can't help but wonder where some of these ideas come from. I go back to a story of yours, the Semplica Girl Diaries. Mm-hmm. Am I pronouncing that right?
You are, yeah.
And that book, that story, you tell us, came from a really strange dream you had at one point, right?
Yeah.
What did you dream?
Well, we had just moved to Syracuse, and I had a teaching job, and we got a kind of a nice house, and we had our kids set up in a nice school. And I had a dream in which I woke up, went to a non-existent window, and looked into our backyard, and there were these five or six women, young women, that I understood to be from third world countries, and they were in the yard in these white smocks, but they were hanging from a kind of a rack. There was like a wire that was run through their heads, almost like paper dolls. And so that was weird enough. But then the person that I was in the dream, instead of being appalled, he was kind of like, "Thank God I finally arrived. You know, we're so lucky." And the sense was that this was some kind of a middle-class lawn ornament that the person I was in the dream had just gotten enough money to acquire. So, yeah. So that, I mean, mostly my dream life is pretty calm, but every so often it spits up something like that. And I just,
so then where do these fantastical stories that you create in Lincoln and the Bardo come from?
Well, I think, you know, it's funny. I think I have a pretty wild mind. My mind is sort of careening all over the place and pretty energetic. But I think mostly what it comes from is having taught myself to revise. Because my guess would be anybody can access some pretty strange stuff in terms of story structure if you keep going back to the story again and again, day after day. Because what you're really doing is not, it's not really about imagination, I don't think. But it's about staying close enough in touch with the text that you see the various crossroads that you come to. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you if you start with a certain notion and you come back to it again and again, you'll kind of burn through the obvious things. You know, the first draft mind is pretty facile, and I don't care who you are, the first draft is always pretty standard. That's just the way the mind works. But as you stay in that text for many months, you burn through the obvious things, and the unusual choices present, and you start to see which ones of those are the most meaningful. So it I don't think it's really wild imagination as much as it is kind of the discipline of taking a microscope to your mental processes and identifying the more nuanced or interesting places within it, which for me only takes place with many iterations of a draft.
Well, you talk about that in terms of how you come to understand your characters. You know, I know I've talked about a certain kind of ventriloquism that goes on as you write and as you pursue in your character's specificity.
Yes.
You tell a story about a process that you say hypothetically, what if I start by writing that Bob is an a-hole?
Yeah.
Right?
Right. So that's a perfectly workable English sentence, but the habit of revision introduces a certain habit of questioning in your mind. So when you say Bob's an a-hole, the fictive part of yourself should say, okay, how so? And then you're forced to supply details. So you might say, okay, Bob is an a-hole because he snapped at the barista. That's better. Suddenly we have a specific action. Then the god of fiction says, why do you think Bob did that? And again, this is maybe the most magical moment in art, is that when that question arises, why did he do that? You can either logically think about it or you can intuitively lurch after it. And for me, the latter is more productive. So I say, Bob snapped at the barista because she reminded him of his wife, his dead wife.
Oh.
Right. Now, that was actually just a sentence lurch that popped into my head. I honor it because I know that the subconscious is deep and it's smart, smarter than me. And it's always supplying these lines. So suddenly, in sort of two swipes of the pen, we've gone from a kind of reductive, slightly condescending Bob as an a-hole to Bob snapped at the barista who reminded him of his dead wife, who he loved dearly and missed every day of his life. You know, suddenly Bob, he may still behave like an a-hole, but suddenly we're on his side a little bit. He's come alive for us.
And, by making him that specific and explaining his motives that specifically, he becomes more universal, which is the interesting thing about how a process like that works.
Yes. And so there's kind of a way in which if you're revising like that, your judgment falls and your curiosity rises. So you get this kind of beautiful three-way empathy fest with the writer's being more empathetic to Bob, but I would argue I'm also being more in touch with my reader, because I'm saying to the reader, let's take a little moment together here and honor Bob with our attention. But I'm also saying, let me honor you, dear reader, with my attention by not being facile about Bob. You know, but this is true even if your characters are terrible. It's better to know the specificity of a terrible person than just a sort of vague, judgmental.
Well, I was going to ask you whether that process ever works to make someone less empathetic, because people have said about you. Tobias Wolff, who was one of your teachers when you were at Syracuse, said about you once, he is such a generous spirit, you'd be embarrassed to behave in a small way around him. And Joshua Ferris, one of your fellow writers, wrote, Saunders is somehow more than just a writer. He writes like something of a saint. He seems in touch with some better being. Is it, in fact, important to you Does Bob have to go on a path that makes him more empathetic and possibly more likable? Can he be more dislikable?
Yes, yes. I don't think empathy has anything to do with whether a person improves. And maybe, you know, I use the word empathy, but maybe that isn't quite right. If you look at somebody who is in opposition to you and is truly doing terrible things, if you look at him through the fiction writer's lens, there's no contradiction in saying, I'm going to understand the world from his point of view, and I'm going to still dislike him, or I'm going to still resist him. In fact, to me, those things are the same. You know, if there was somebody who was trying to do something harmful to you, it seems to me the most powerful thing you could do is spend 2 or 3 minutes in his head. You know, because then you would have 100% knowledge of what his motivations were and so on. So I don't, empathy to me doesn't necessarily mean, you know, new age lovey-dovey feelings, but it means clear sight with the judgment turned down as low as you can get it. Because, you know, when we prejudge things, what we basically do is exclude data. Mm-hmm. You know, if you know, you know, what somebody from such and such a city is, and you can't stand people from that city, well, you've got a big block up, or sort of a scrim up that's going to keep all the data out. Whereas if you say, I don't know anything, I'm just going to be 100% awareness and 0% judgment, then you're going to get a lot of interesting facts. So I think for me, the process of revision is sort of a way of training myself in that kind of thinking. You know, these boxing trainers say that you don't want to go into the ring emotional.
So in a book like Lincoln and the Bardo, can you quantify for us how many drafts, how many revisions you went through before you were finally satisfied and sent the book off to your publisher?
I can't really quantify it because it was 4 years, probably, you know, 5 days a week. Yeah, it'd be hard to quantify, but okay. I know it's hundreds, you know, it's hundreds. And basically the technique was I'd start in the morning reading from page one and work through to where I was, and it just polished behind me and then move ahead. So everything was always up for grabs until the very last minute. Every bit of prose is negotiable.
Is it done now?
Actually, no, there's another part of that where I think, you know, especially with a long book like this, you get to the end and there's a period of ripeness where your subconscious is as engaged as it's ever going to be. And so it's almost like, you know, it's like if you're going to ask somebody to marry you, there's a golden zone where you should do that. And if you wait too long, it's a little bit unkind, yeah. You know? So I think with the last third of this book, I remember thinking, okay, this has got to be done in the next 2 or 3 months or that golden zone's going to pass.
Yeah.
So I think it's done. I think, you know, I think there's I was at Faulkner's house one time in the museum, and he had this beautiful thing on the wall where it's kind of like, you know, I have often finished a work and thought of ways to go back and change it. And been tempted to do so, but then the next work would appear on the horizon and I'd be off to the chase, you know.
Let's talk about what appears to me to be a preoccupation with death. It permeates, it is in so many of the stories that you've written. It obviously is a major theme in Lincoln and the Bardo. Let's start that part of the conversation, if we could. You had an experience, what, 2-3 decades ago, a near-death experience of your own on a plane between Chicago and Syracuse?
Yeah, it was 1999 or 2000. It was before 9/11. I was just, you know, coming back from some book event and reading a magazine, and then it sounded like we took off from Chicago and we were still ascending, and it sounded like a minivan hit the side of the plane. And then this black smoke started coming out of those air things, you know, all up and down the aisle. And there was a girl's softball team. They were screaming, and the plane was kind of dropping in this really alarming way. And, I think in that situation, I always thought I would be the guy who stood up and said, everybody, don't worry. Death is going to be fine. We've had wonderful lives. Let's be grateful, you know. But that's not who I was at all. So I just sat. I mean, really, you know, I joke about it now, but it was terrifying. And, nobody was explaining what was going on, and the plane was, you know, I know Chicago, and I could see the grid of the streets, and we were dropping pretty fast. And I just was, you know, I mean, to tell you the truth, what happened was I didn't think about my writing career. I couldn't even turn my mind to my family. I could barely remember my name. And it was just this kind of nonstop inner monologue that went, no, 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 not now, you know, like that. And I remember looking up at the seat in front of me and thinking, oh my God, I have to get out of this body now. Oh. And that is not going to be easy. And it's that seat that's going to do it one way or the other. So I don't know how, it felt like hours, but it was probably 10 or 15 minutes. And I just, you know, all you want to do is reverse time and not get on that plane, and you're trapped, you know? And so, but what finally got me out of this, there was a 14-year-old boy sitting to my left at the window seat. And all of a sudden I hear him and he goes, sir, is this supposed to be happening? Ugh. And I just thought, oh, God, all right. So we talked to him a little bit. And I think at one point I was holding hands with him and the woman across the aisle. And then the pilot comes on and he shouts, stay in your seat with your seatbelts on. He didn't seem calm, you know. But what had happened was a goose or some geese had flown into the engine and took it out.
Yeah.
So they were able to land it with one engine. But they never really told us what was happening. So, I mean, that was really something. And at the time, I think I was, doing a good amount of meditation and certainly more than I'm doing now. And I was not ready. And I suspect that I'm not ready now either.
Yeah, you said at one point, I'm interested in getting myself to believe it's going to happen to me. If death is in the room, it's pretty interesting in terms of your writing. But I would say I'm interested in getting myself to believe it's going to happen to me. To me, it's what you should be thinking about all the time. Wow.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and I don't mean that, you know, it sounds maudlin or something, but sad.
Go ahead, talk about this, because it doesn't sound maudlin to me. It sounds focused to me about life, not death.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's kind of what the spiritual traditions are trying to tell us, is that we have this temporary fog that we walk around in, which we call normal, but it's made up of our senses, which we know are extremely limited, and it's made up of our thought stream, which is also quite a kind of a Darwinian construction to keep us alive. But the universe, whatever it is happening way beyond our comprehension. In some ways, maybe thank goodness we have these little minds that put us at the center of the narrative, puts our permanence in mind. You know, everyone else dies, but we don't. So that's a delusion, actually. It's a comforting delusion, and maybe we need to stay in it in order to function. But I think the sacred traditions exist to just drop that veil every now and then and say, death is coming. How might that change the way you live? How might that change the way you love? I think the evidence of these incredible spiritual beings is that if you really could get in relation to that, it would make life just unbelievably joyful. You know, the fact that the party is ending at midnight doesn't mean it's not a good party.
And that's what really brings us back to Lincoln and the Bardo, because that's what's happening to every character, with the exception of Lincoln, although he's contemplating death too, but in a different way. Your characters are all there trying to understand that they are dead, but beyond just trying to understand that, trying to figure out how to let go.
Right. And I would say that's kind of what we're trying to do. You know, we're trying to understand that we're dead, because basically we are. You know, we flared up briefly.
Thanks, George.
Yeah, but I mean, but we're trying to find a way to live joyfully and with a sense of humor and with some loving kindness, even though the expiration date is soon. And that's essentially what they're doing too. And just like they are, we tend to spend a lot of energy denying that state. You know, they deny that they're dead. I think I certainly deny that I'm dying. I'm doing it right now, even though I'm talking a good game. So I, about halfway through the book, I thought, oh yeah, this isn't a book about death at all, or the dead at all. It's a book, you know, about us.
I know there's a passage of the book that you like to read. I want our listeners to hear from you yourself. You're reading a little bit of the book. The language is poetic, gorgeous, sometimes mystifying, sometimes incredibly funny. And I really would love it if you'd share a little section with us and tell us what you're going to read. Set it up for us.
Sure. We talked earlier about how these ghosts admire the living so much, and they're a little defensive about their current state. So this is just a speech that there's a character named the Reverend Everly Thomas, and he's been there a long time. And he's the only character who actually has sort of an idea of what's actually happened to him.
He has a pretty terrifying idea
he's been to
them.
Right, he's been to the judgment and come racing back, so he kind of keeps a tight lips about it. But here he's just, Lincoln has just been there, and he's kind of making the case here for why these Ghost feels so tender about this. So he says, please do not misunderstand. We had been mothers, fathers, had been husbands of many years, men of import, who had come here that first day, accompanied by crowds so vast and sorrowful that, surging forward to hear the oration, they had damaged fences beyond repair. Had been young wives, diverted here during childbirth, our gentle qualities stripped from us by the naked pain of that circumstance, who left behind husbands so enamored of us, so tormented by the horror of those last moments, the notion that we had gone down that awful black hole, pain sundered from ourselves, that they had never loved again, had been bulky men, quietly content, who, in our first youth, had come to grasp our own unremarkableness and had cheerfully, as if bemusedly accepting a heavy burden, shifted our life's focus. If we would not be great, we would be useful, would be rich and kind, and thereby able to effect good, smiling, hands in pockets, watching the world we had subtly improved walking past, this empty dowry filled, that education secretly funded, had been affable, joking servants, of whom our masters had grown fond for the cheering words we managed as they launched forth on days full of import, had been grandmothers, tolerant and frank, recipients of certain dark secrets who, by the quality of their unjudging listening, granted tacit forgiveness, and thus let in the sun. What I mean to say is we had been considerable, had been loved, not lonely, not lost, not freakish, but wise, each in his or her own way. Our departures caused pain. Those who had loved us sat upon their beds, heads in hand, lowered their faces to tabletops, making animal noises. We had been loved, I say, and remembering us, even many years later, people would smile, briefly gladdened at the memory.
That's George Saunders reading an excerpt from Lincoln in the Bardo. It's a beautiful passage, and it seems so right. It's exactly what we want, isn't it? Confirmation that we have lived, that we've made an impact, that people will remember us when we're gone. It's a beautiful passage, George.
Thank you. Thank you.
Let's take another break. More with George Saunders in a minute. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. Let's get back to our conversation with George Saunders. It was recorded in March, shortly after publication of his first novel, Lincoln in the Bardo.
You grew up in the Chicago. You grew up in Chicago, basically.
Yes.
And you knew, I think, fairly early on you wanted to be a writer, but you went out to Los Angeles. You had a girlfriend. It didn't work out there. You lost the girl and came back to try to figure out, to sort out your life, and ended up in Syracuse in the writing program there. Is that is that a quick and accurate description?
You left out a lot of petty humiliations, but yeah, that's a generous way of putting
okay,
it.
Okay, well, let's go back then, because I think it's kind of interesting. You went out to L.A. with this high school sweetheart who you were crazy about. How did that work out there?
Well, I mean, basically I was an idiot and I went out there, went with no money and no plans and crashed with some friends and was a tremendous imposition. And then I worked as a doorman in Beverly Hills and, had the idea of being a writer, but didn't have any discipline about it and really hadn't read quite enough at that point. So You know, it was sort of just your kind of standard American story of, as Terry Eagleton says, capitalism plundering the sensuality of the body, you know. So it was kind of a fun hippie period. And we came back to Chicago, and I lived with my aunt and was a roofer for a while, and that relationship broke up. And so it was just kind of, I mean, this was mostly me being an idiot, but then went back to Texas and worked as in the slaughterhouse for a while. And the big crisis was I knew I wanted to write, but I wasn't doing much of it, partly because of the, you know, the pace of living, but also because I was kind of afraid to start. So I was at this kind of crazy party in Amarillo, and I drifted away from the craziness and picked up a People magazine. And there was an article about Raymond Carver and Jay McInerney and the Syracuse Creative Writing Program. And I, at that point, I didn't even know such a thing existed. So I applied and got in, and that was a life changer. Went there and met my wife. We got engaged in 3 weeks in the romantic Syracuse ambiance, and we're going on 30 years now. So,
congratulations.
Thank you.
As you moved toward the Syracuse Writer Program, one of the other things you did was to go to Sumatra, where you worked deep in the countryside, where you had you were a 45-minute helicopter ride from any kind of civilized city, right?
Yeah, I was a geophysics major, yeah. So I got a job in the oil business, and this was sort of exploration in the deep jungles there, which is great. And that was actually where I did a lot of reading, because we were so far away from civilization.
And that's important. That's what I wanted to get. That's where you really discovered Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah, I what we would do is we'd work 4 weeks on and get 2 weeks off. So the 4 weeks on, we're in the jungle, and then we'd fly to Singapore. So the last thing I would do before I came back for the next hitch was to just take a whole suitcase and just load it with books, go to a bookstore and just fill that bag up. And it was pretty interesting because I didn't really know enough to pick out only the good books. So I got some garbage and I got some great things. And I think that's where I first read Slaughterhouse-Five was on that trip. And at the time, it didn't really, you know, I was kind of a big Hemingway guy. And my first read of that book was that Vonnegut was why was he being funny about war, and why was he being sort of flippant? And it took me a number of years to really understand how profound that book was, but it definitely got in my head at that point.
Yeah, and Vonnegut, for anybody who's read Vonnegut and has been reading you, we see parallels in your love for using science fiction to make comments about our lives today. And I want to talk just for a few minutes, because I want to lead to a quote from Vonnegut that I think seems to me to sum up a lot of your philosophy about your work and your life. You talked a while ago about this, really, about the relationship that you think the writer can create with the reader, and that it's more than passive. It's not just a reader reads your book and goes off and forgets about it. You talk about empathy. You talk about creating characters that we can relate to. And you talk about the fact that if you do it right, you soften the borders between you and me, you the writer and me the reader. And you say it makes us wiser, better, more disciplined in our openness to the experience of other people.
Yeah, I mean, I say that only because it's happened to me so many times. Yeah. You know, I remember reading The Bluest Eye when our kids were little, Toni Morrison's great novel. And there was literally some kind of neurological dropping in. Or maybe it was a dropping back in, because I'd had this notion when I was a little Catholic kid in Chicago, but this notion that the most powerful stance you could take in this life is vast love for everybody. Now, and maybe it's not a stance. I mean, you can't choose it, but if you can get into that state, as we occasionally do, you would be like a superhero. And this is the way that Jesus was explained to us as young kids in Chicago, that Jesus has such vast empathy for everybody, no exceptions, that he was totally fearless.
I'm so glad that's what you said, because I will share with you now, and I'm sure you know it, one of the great, great passages from Vonnegut. In God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, Elliot Rosewater is asked at one point to, I think, give a little speech or a prayer at the christening of a baby. And here's what he says. He says, "Hello, babies. Welcome to Earth. It's hot in the summer and cold in the winter. It's round and wet and crowded. On the outside, babies, you've got 100 years here. There's only one rule that I know of, babies. God damn it, you've got to be kind."
Yeah, amen. But, you know, and I think, too, that the thing that, that I love in Vonnegut is that kindness isn't this kind of vacuous, you know, kumbaya kindness. To me, kindness means it means awareness of what's actually going on. And it, maybe it means the resolution to try to be kind. It certainly isn't the case that you just can do it. I certainly can't. But it seems to me if you start from the assumption that everybody is just as real as you are, it leads to a pretty functional way of living. And it also seems to me to be self-proving. You know, if you go out in the world and you discipline yourself to at least try to believe that everybody is wants to be happy, just like you do, then at hundreds of little points throughout the day, you make the right call. You know, so it's not, I don't think it's an edict, but I think it's an aspiration, maybe.
So one of the joys of the direction that Lincoln and the Bardo takes us is that these spirits, which feel powerless, ineffective, find a way, and we won't talk about it in detail, at the end to come together to accomplish something meaningful. And it's a very powerful image toward the end of your book. But I want to go ahead. I'm sorry.
But you know, what's funny about it, I thank you for noticing that, that was not my intention.
Really?
Which was funny. It just happened over the many revisions. And the way I see it is there was almost like this viral, like a viral goodness thing going on where 9 or 10 different characters made small decisions that added up to this happy effect. And so, I think that, again, it was inadvertent, but I think that's actually true in the world. Now, it's also true in the other direction. I think people can make, you know, dozens of negative decisions that cause a bad outcome. But it seems to me that, you know, I like that idea that no small good action is truly meaningless. Even a, you know, a sort of smile in the subway or something, you don't actually know what effect that might have. So I don't know that it's true, but it certainly is kind of empowering because it gives you a way to get through a day. If you could imagine a day as being 15,000 opportunities to be 10% more aware than you normally are, and then have faith that enacting that mind state would actually improve the world in some incremental way. That's, for me, I find that a little bit cheering, much more than the idea of going out and trying to protect yourself or get yours or not be played for a sucker or something like that.
So as we come to a close, as I told you, I thought about that Elliot Rosewater quote in relation to the way in which you ended one of your stories. And it seems to me to be a good stopping point. If you don't mind my reading your words back to
please
you.
Please do.
And then I'll ask you to just say a couple words about this. You ended a story this way. Don't be afraid to be confused. Try to remain permanently confused. Anything is possible. Stay open forever. So open it hurts. And then open up some more until the day you die. World without end. Amen.
Yes, I did write that. But in the context of the story, it's kind of a self-admonition. You know, I don't think I've done that ever once in my life, but that was the end of a pretty mind-blowing trip. And I just was kind of saying to myself a little, you know, arch-rhapsodically, you know, when you go home, please try to remember that though our inclination is to close and our inclination is to know and to control and to dominate, a much more holy impulse is to constantly be urging yourself in the direction of confusion or ambiguity, because then you're actually more you're more adept at doing whatever good there is to do.
Seems like a pretty good lesson to me, George.
Well, if I can only do it, fake it till I make it.
Right. Well, that's exactly right. We will do our best to fake it until we actually make it. George Saunders, Lincoln and the Bardo is a remarkable book. You've been hearing that from critics, from a lot of other people. So I just want to add my voice to that chorus to tell you it was a joy to read, and I can't recommend it enough to our listeners. Thank you so much for spending time with us on Two-Way Street today.
Bill, you're the best, man. Thank you. That was so energizing.
You can learn more about George Saunders, about his novel Lincoln and the Bardo, and about his other work on our website at gpb.org/TWS and on our Facebook page. Before we leave you today, a quick note about next week's show. I'm going to be talking with Emily Saliers. She's one half of one of the most successful pairings in contemporary music, the Indigo Girls. Emily joins us to talk about and play from her first solo album. Plus, we'll talk about the role that faith plays in her life, and of course, we'll talk about the Indigo Girls, too. That's next week on Two-Way Street. Our senior producer is Jenny Ament. Jenny edited today's show. Our associate producer is Olivia Rheingold, and our engineer is Tyler Morris. I'm Bill Nygut. Again, our thoughts are with all of you across the state as you recover from Hurricane Irma. See you again next week.